On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
But what about the promise
to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Privis. I told my weed guy to step it up and he gave me that.
What is this?
It's called Mind. It's actually pretty mellow.
It doesn't sound very mellow.
Well, he only had three other batches. Gorilla Panic, They're Coming, and something called This Is Permanent. Come on, spark it up. There you go. You got it. Nice. Good, huh? Good job.
Yeah.
Take pride in that.
Well, in honor of April 20th, or 420, that's Mark Wahlberg and a teddy bear smoking pot in the movie Ted. Well, this time next year, 420 could have a whole new meaning here in California because voters are expected to legalize it in November. At one point, 20 marijuana initiatives tried to get on the ballot. The odds-on favorite now is the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, the one backed by tech billionaire Sean Parker. But if pot becomes legal here, it may create a whole new set of problems that the law may not do a good job of addressing. Like, how will the cops know when you're too stoned to drive? Colorado became the first state to make recreational marijuana legal in 2012, so we thought we'd see what happened there to get a sense of what we might be in for. So we called up Ricardo Baca, marijuana editor of the Denver Post and founder and editor of the Post's website called The Cannabist. Happy 420, Ricardo.
Hey, happy 420 to you, too.
Are people celebrating in the streets there in Denver?
You know, it's always a little bit weird when 420 falls in the middle of the week. But sure enough, this past weekend was incredibly busy. Tonight's really busy, just not as crazy as it is when it falls on a Saturday. And then there's some more events throughout the rest of the week.
Okay, well, let's start with the question that I raised in the introduction, and that is, how does Colorado handle whether you're too stoned to drive? What are the laws?
You know, the laws are very similar to what they are with alcohol. You can't get high and drive legally. Of course, it's difficult because this is a new era. And what's the cannabis equivalent to having a buzz? And these are all things that we're trying to figure out. But, you know, the Colorado State Patrol, as well as the Department of Transportation here, has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on education campaigns, as well as officer training. So not only are they educating the public that, hey, this isn't okay, they've come out with some casual and fun and hip young ads kind of educating the public, but also more officers are trained in Colorado for roadside cannabis detection programs.
Well, how do they do that? Is there a breathalyzer test?
You know, actually, it's funny you say that. They are working on that. Right now, the exact methodology of figuring out somebody's THC intoxication relies on a blood test, and it's a very imperfect blood test. So the state and other states are actually paying technology companies to commission the development of breathalyzers that will be more accurate representations of exact THC impairment.
So now is it just up to the individual officer to determine whether or not someone is too stoned to drive?
You know, it is. They've certainly gone under that through a pretty rigorous roadside testing program, and it's something we've covered a lot.
And have there been more accidents related to stone driving?
You know, the statistics are weird because imagine you have an entity like the Colorado State Patrol. They've always kept data on DUIs and DUIDs. But they never separated out the DUIDs to, oh, this was a DUI for cannabis.
And wait, DUID is driving under the influence of drugs?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, at least that's what they call it out here. So they never previously separated marijuana from opiates to different drugs, and they only started doing that last year. But some fascinating data just came out in the last couple months on this. Colorado State Patrol actually saw fewer marijuana-impacted DUIs in 2015 than they did in all of 2014. So it seems like the public is becoming aware that, hey, this is just like alcohol. Don't do it.
We have heard horror stories about people being incapacitated by edibles. And on the other side, people not getting any effect at all from edibles. It just seems that the concentration of THC is all over the map. Has there been any move in Colorado to some kind of standardized labeling?
You know, there have been multiple moves. In fact, if you asked a state legislator here what they've talked the most about regarding cannabis, it probably would be edibles. You know, how are they packaged? How are they labeled? How do they look once they're outside of that package? That's a conversation that's happening right now at the state capitol. Of course, we've had pot brownies since the 60s and 70s, but only now are we seeing pot brownies in a regulated market so open that anyone over 21 can go in and buy that. And it has a different reaction to everybody. It depends on your weight. It depends on have you eaten yet. It depends on so many things that it. A lot of people are getting tripped up and landing in hospital emergency rooms. And thankfully, nothing serious is happening regularly with these people. Of course, THC isn't a deadly substance, so doctors are typically giving them fluids, assuring them that it's going to be okay, giving them privacy, and they leave a couple hours later once they're feeling better.
What's happened to the illegal market?
You know, the black market by its very nature is indefinable, of course, but what we have seen, that figure I mentioned earlier, $996 million in sales. I mean, that doesn't happen in a newly regulated, newly legalized market without taking a chunk out of the black market. Of course, there's still the underground, and what we're now starting to see are more and more people come to Colorado from elsewhere, especially the East Coast and other countries, rent a house, grow plants, which you can grow a certain number of plants legally, 6 to 12, but they're growing 100 plants with the intention of then, you know, bringing the product out of state and selling it for high prices illegally on the black market there. So we're certainly seeing that, but I think one really encouraging statistic we're also seeing on the federal level is fewer grabs of illegal product crossing the border between Mexico and the U.S. We have direct reports from Mexican farmers who wish that legalization wasn't happening because it's lowering their per kilo prices that they're selling it to the cartel bosses for. And the U.S. government is telling us that less marijuana annually is being captured at those Texas and California and Arizona borders than ever before. So certainly you could lead that to say that legalization is working in that space.
There is some worry here, as I'm sure there has been in other states such as yours, that legalizing pot will make it easier for kids to get their hands on it and to get high.
You know, that's a legitimate concern. I think children have to be a major part of this conversation. I know the pro-legalization movement is quick to say in situations like this that have kids ever had a hard time finding marijuana in the last 20 years? And I can go back 20 years ago to my high school experience and say, anytime I wanted it, I could have had it. And that's 20 years ago, and I think it's only more readily available now, whether you live in a legal state or not. Mm. At the same time, it does change when it goes from an illicit black market to when anyone over the age of 21 can walk into a shop and buy it after flashing their ID. So, you know, this is something that I know is incredibly important to Colorado's health department, and it's one of the statistics they're watching most carefully.
And what have they seen so far?
You know, the data is limited because here we are in early 2016. We just don't quite have enough time under our belt to be able to tell that. But one very important study came out late last year. It was from a federal agency. It's called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and they did show that teen monthly use of cannabis in Colorado from 2013 to 2014 had no statistical change. So it didn't go up, it didn't go down. Colorado has always had very high use, very high teen use, so we are in that top percentile of use. But it didn't really change from 2013, where the sales hadn't started yet, to 2014, where they had. So that's encouraging. But again, it's only that first year of data.
So it's been a couple of years since pot was legal in Colorado. Have you seen it become more socially acceptable in the mainstream? In other words, could you go to an after work party with your colleagues and, you know, have a joint offered to you the way you might have a drink offered to you?
Immensely. And, you know, of course, it depends on your social circles, but this has really become normalized. I mean, we saw legalization become commercialization, and now that's becoming normalization. And seriously, the dinner party analogy is a great one, because 5 years ago, if I was hosting a dinner party or going out, it was certainly, hey, yeah, bring a bottle. And now it's a very different situation where there's a much wider assortment of intoxicants on the table. And one of my favorite stories I've ever written was about a friend of mine. We went to her birthday party and brought her a couple pre-rolled joints instead of a bottle of champagne. And she was thrilled and dragged us over to this bowl that was on a table. And she put the joints in there. And it was just overflowing with edibles and cannabis. And she goes, you guys were like the 10th people to bring me this weed. Everybody knows me so well. Thank you.
All right. Well, happy 420 to you and all your colleagues and your friend.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
Thank you. That's Ricardo Baca, marijuana editor at the Denver Post. Well, if you get the chance, will you vote to legalize pot? And even if you're pro-legalization, are you worried about some of these issues, issues that still have not been ironed out fully in Colorado? Well, let us know what you think at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Okay, onto a drug now that is a lot more troubling. It's called fentanyl. It is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin. Fentanyl is a synthetic painkiller given mainly to cancer patients, but it's also a street drug known as China White, Apache, and TNT. Illegal fentanyl comes in many different forms: alone, blended into heroin or cocaine, or it's purposely mislabeled as familiar names like Norco or OxyContin. In the Sacramento area alone, there have been more than 50 fentanyl-related overdoses, 11 of them deadly since last month. Health officials across the state are on alert. Dr. Karen Smith is director of the California Department of Public Health, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, your department issued a statewide advisory on fentanyl earlier this month, but 2 years ago, L.A. County had some, I think, 62 fentanyl-related deaths. So why didn't the state respond earlier?
Well, I wasn't in this position 2 years ago, but at that time, there wasn't the recognition that this issue of fentanyl being actually in the illicit drug supply chain was going to become as big a challenge as it was. And so typically, when there's a very focal outbreak, as in, because these are very similar to infectious disease outbreaks in terms of the way they crop up, we would work with the local jurisdiction, in that case Los Angeles County, to be sure that they had all the resources that they needed. We don't necessarily alert the entire state to an issue like that unless it becomes clear that it's spreading. And so there were a couple of things that were different about the Sacramento event this past couple of weeks. One was the speed at which it occurred. There were so many overdoses and deaths within the first 10-day period that was alarming. And then we started to see some additional overdoses in surrounding counties as well. And at that point, we decided that because we didn't know how fast it was going to move, mm-hmm. we don't have a lot of information about how these drugs spread around the state, that we needed to be sure that every single health department in the state and all the hospitals were aware that this was an issue.
So where are people getting this drug?
Well, I don't have specific information about that. My understanding from talking with our colleagues in the Drug Enforcement Agency, the precursor drug to fentanyl comes from China typically, and it's the same thing is used both for U.S. manufacturers of legitimate fentanyl and also those that are engaged in manufacturing it illegally. It's a very simple chemical reaction to go from that drug to the actual fentanyl, which is what's active in human beings. And so typically it's cheaper to purchase the material in large quantities from China and then do that last step in the production of manufacturing yourself. Whether this is being manufactured within the U.S., what's currently circulating, or whether it's in Mexico coming across to the U.S., we don't know.
So fentanyl, talk a little bit about this drug. Is it part of the prescription drug overdose problem that we've been hearing about? Is this drug especially potent in this class of drugs?
Fentanyl has been used for a very long time to dilute, if you will, heroin and cocaine. These are drugs that are more expensive. Fentanyl is very cheap, and the manufacture is easy. So pure economics works out well for the illicit drug seller because they're using a cheaper material too. And still, because it's a very potent, as you said earlier, drug in humans, it is they get the same high, the user. What's new right now is that this most recent series of overdoses and deaths in Sacramento appears to be related to pretty pure fentanyl. So not fentanyl used to cut another drug or to dilute another drug, but fentanyl itself and shaped into pills that are virtually indistinguishable from legitimate prescription medication, the morphine derivative that goes by the name Norco, mm-hmm. which is a very popular drug for people to use on the street. And so these are folks who we hear anecdotally from talking to those who've had an overdose and survived and their friends. People get these in very kind of close-knit circles. So the drug dealer tends to be somebody's friend rather than, you know, going to some darkened street corner. And so they're used to that being a reliable source. And now what we're seeing is it's flooding the market in that region with these counterfeit Norco, which are extremely dangerous. People think that they're taking their normal dose of one or two tablets. That one or two tablets is more like 100 to 200 times what they would normally take.
So they're unwittingly taking this fentanyl.
Exactly.
They're not doing it on purpose.
Exactly. That's why our key message to folks is if you didn't buy this drug directly from a pharmacy, a legitimate pharmacy, don't take it because you don't know what's in it.
So are people selling it on the streets because it's cheaper than Norco or any of the other drugs?
Well, we're not sure whether the people actually locally who are selling this to their friends had any idea that they weren't selling Norco. It's we believe that the major distributor, whoever that is, in fact, that's exactly why they're making these pills that look like Norco into fentanyl. They can sell for 50 to 100 times the amount of material for a fraction of the cost. Norco's becomes very expensive as we've started to really cut back on the legitimate prescription use of that drug. And as a consequence, the cost of the drug on the street has gone way up. So substituting fentanyl works economically for them because they can make a great deal more money.
So not all overdoses from fentanyl are fatal. Does it need to be combined with another drug to be fatal?
No, it doesn't. It's really about the quantity of the drug that you ingest, mm-hmm. your own, you know, whether you're a large person or a small person. But it also depends on how quickly you get into care because there's a drug called naloxone, which is an opioid antagonist, meaning it literally reverses opioid effect sort of instantaneously when you give it to somebody by injection. It's a remarkable thing. Somebody who's very clearly, you know, unconscious or only minimally conscious from a drug overdose, and you give them a shot of this drug and they wake up. Stone cold sober, as my father would say. And that drug is very, very effective. It's also effective against fentanyl. The challenge that we've seen with this most recent street drug has been that it's a longer acting drug, and so there have been some people who've overdosed. Typically with a heroin overdose, you just have to give people one shot of this naloxone. They wake up, you watch them for a little while, they're fine, they go home. There have been a number of cases in the Sacramento area where they've had to give repeated doses of naloxone over a period of hours because the fentanyl was staying in their system for such a long time.
Wow. And so did doctors recognize this? Do they know how to handle a fentanyl overdose when it appears before them?
Well, I think most emergency room physicians are very well versed in how to deal with narcotic overdoses. And so the good thing about this was that the initial treatment for a fentanyl overdose is exactly the same as it would have been for a heroin overdose, which is this naloxone and then careful observation. But the doses that people have taken are so high that with the fentanyl that they figured out fairly quickly that this was not your normal overdose. For one thing, often people brought in the pills as well, and so it became clear pretty quickly after the first few overdoses that this was not your typical drug, that people were getting very high doses, and that makes the overdose much more dangerous.
Well, Dr. Smith, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dr. Karen Smith. She's director of the California Department of Public Health. Coming up, March was the hottest on record, following the hottest February and the hottest January. What global warming is doing to the ocean here in Southern California, next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. As we keep pumping millions of tons of CO2 into the air every day, we are making the oceans more acidic. And that means messing with our marine life. Oysters and other shellfish are having trouble building their shells. Salmon and other fish are losing some of their sources of food. And because of the way ocean currents work, the problem is even worse here on the West Coast. A new report out this month looks closely at this problem. It was written by the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. Francis Chan helped write that report. He's an ecologist and associate professor at Oregon State University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, how bad is the problem right now?
Well, there's both good news and bad news in that it's bad enough that we can measure the changes in the ocean. And when you think about the sheer size of the ocean, to have changes face very basic chemistry, that's pretty incredible. But the positive note is that we haven't crossed all the tipping points that we're worried about yet. So there's time to do some actions.
Okay, so what are some of the harmful effects of increased ocean acidification? How is it affecting marine life?
Right. So it turns out that things that build shells in the sea, for example, appear to be some of the most sensitive marine animals. And things that build shells are your clams, your oysters, your lobsters, your crabs. And we're starting to see some effects certainly from the shellfish industry side, so that the shellfish, the oyster growers, are already having a hard time and are changing the way they grow oysters just to deal with this issue.
Right. So we keep hearing oysters are the so-called canary in the coal mine. Is that true?
That's right. They are the canary, which means that they're probably the first and most sensitive, which also means that there are things behind it that are stacking up to show effects. And some of the things that we're starting to look at as a scientific community are the plankton. So there's something called sea butterfly, and it's a zooplankton. It's a source of food for lots of fishes. And it, too, builds a shell, and it turns out that when you go out there and collect these organisms in the waters off the U.S. West Coast right now, you can see that the shells are already starting to dissolve. So this is changes that are happening today.
And which fish eat the plankton, that plankton?
A large host of them, but the one that you know I find most delicious is the salmon.
Hmm. Okay, and it's worse, as I said, in the Pacific. Why is that?
That's right. Well, along the U.S. West Coast, we have this ocean current upwelling. This is a very good thing because the upwelling currents is what brings deep water, which is chock full of nutrients, to the surface. And this nutrient, it's fertilizer. It fertilizes a coastal ocean, and it's why we have such an amazingly productive coast where we live here. But the downside is that the water that is being upwelled from deeper in the ocean is also naturally high in CO2. So whatever additional CO2 we happen to add to it, it's more likely to change the chemistry to push it closer past biological thresholds.
So what's happening in the Pacific is something that won't happen in the other oceans for many decades to come?
You're right. So we're ahead of the curve. We're a harbinger of changes to come. So, and that's really important because we need to act faster than the rest of the world. But it also means that whatever we learn here along the U.S. coast, West Coast, can be lessons that other parts of the country and other parts of the world can use.
So what have we learned?
Well, we used to think of this as this giant, intractable global problem. You know, just nothing much that we can do about it because it's global carbon emissions. Nothing for my state, my city, your city do about it. But when we look at the science, we see that there's a whole host of local actions that we can and probably should take to better prepare us for the changes ahead.
And what are they?
There are a number of options that are available to us. So if our goal is a healthy, productive fishery or healthy, productive coastal ecosystem, let's look at the other things besides ocean acidification that might be challenging it. And let's make sure that we address those very well. It could be other sources of pollutant. It could be habitat degradation. We also find that locally, when you have productive seagrass beds or productive kelp forests, they can actually modulate the chemistry, and they do it in a good way. They are incredibly productive, and they can draw down CO2. And if effective, they can actually act to guard against the future declines in water chemistry. So the next step is to really find out where and when protecting and restoring seagrass and kelp forests can give us the biggest bang, where they're likely to be most effective.
Is that happening now? Are people planting kelp beds and seagrass beds?
They're protecting, and in some places they're actually restoring seagrass beds. But these activities are done without really any thought to ocean acidification, because that's, you know, really not on their radar now. But it turns out, you know, there might be some added bonuses to those kinds of restoration activities.
So you would look to more government help for this?
You know, this issue appeared very recently. 10 years ago, really nobody and most scientists had not heard of ocean acidification. But now this is something that's probably the number one priority for ocean scientists in terms of finding solutions. At the same time, none of the policies or regulations or even the legislations that we have around ocean, none of them are really designed to address this issue. So I think there's incredible room for us to pivot from this ocean acidification blind view of how we manage ocean to something that is much more aware.
How much time do you think we have
before we start to see big changes?
Yeah.
Unfortunately for us in the West Coast, we're going to start to see bigger changes in water chemistry in the coming decade and decades. So this isn't one of those, an asteroid, maybe 100 years, 1,000-year problem. This is a pretty near-horizon challenge for us. We've seen changes, and we're going to see bigger changes within my lifetime, and certainly within my fifth grader's lifetime. So we need to act now, because if we wait, it's not going to get any easier, and it's not going to get any less difficult to solve the problem.
Francis Chan, ecologist and associate professor at Oregon State University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, the director Karin Kusama is getting a lot of critical praise for her movie, The Invitation. She says that the Hollywood system needs an attitude adjustment when it comes to women filmmakers.
This is an issue in culture in general. You know, who gets the last word of history? Who gets the last word of the narrative? And more women need to own that narrative.
Karin Kusama, next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 16 years ago, director Karin Kusama made a huge splash at the Sundance Film Festival. Her first movie, Girl Fight, was and remains the only film ever to win the festival's Grand Jury Prize and the Directing Award. It starred a then-unknown Michelle Rodriguez as an aspiring fighter.
I'm training to be a boxer.
You mean like Pow Wow Love?
You are crazy.
It's a dangerous sport. Aren't you afraid of getting hurt?
I didn't make the cheerleading team.
But after that first flurry of attention, Kusama found Hollywood was not as welcoming as it appeared. Now, more than a decade later, she has returned to her roots. Kusama's new film, The Invitation, is a small independent thriller. It's set at a dinner party in the Hollywood Hills, and it is getting some serious critical buzz. Karin Kusama joins me in the studio now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's just talk a little bit about The Invitation. Mm-hmm. It's about a man named Will.
Yes.
We can't say too much about it because I don't want to give it away.
It's a tough one, yeah.
It's a tough one, yeah. So he and his girlfriend are invited to a dinner party that mm-hmm. his ex-wife and her boyfriend.
Her new husband.
Her new
yep.
husband.
Are throwing.
So they're throwing this dinner party. Things aren't quite what they seem. And here's a clip from the trailer.
You've been acting so suspicious of our hospitality.
This beautiful moment is upon us. Tonight is the night our faith is made real.
Something doesn't feel safe here.
It's so menacing. Have you ever been to a dinner party that is menacing like that?
I can't say I've been to anything quite as menacing as what happens in my movie, thank God. But I've definitely been to some Hollywood dinner parties that put me on serious edge.
And so your husband co-wrote the screenplay.
That's right. He co-wrote it with his longtime writing partner, Matt Manfredi.
And how did they get you to direct it?
I just fell in love with it as soon as I read it. It was hard for me to contain myself. They had originally thought they were going to direct it. And so I had to sort of hold back from basically just like pounding my chest and saying, please give this to me. So it was a really beautiful, beautiful, spare, precise piece of writing.
And what was it about the story that attracted you, that you said you just really wanted to direct?
The story is so much about the different ways that we approach grief and the way we internalize it or externalize our sorrow. And people in the world of the film behave very differently around what they feel is acceptable in terms of their mourning, and that the characters are linked by the loss of a child. And for me, that's, as someone who has a kid now, it really pushed a lot of buttons because the nightmare of it was so palpable. And it made me feel like almost any kind of behavior would be possible if I had to face that kind of just sort of, I want to say, mind-altering loss. And so I felt tremendous empathy even for the characters in the film who I think one might read as antagonistic. And that seemed very interesting to me in a genre context.
In a genre context, in a horror film, in a thriller context, is
that
what you mean?
Yes.
Where there has to be a bad guy or a bad woman.
Yeah, I think we've sort of made these assumptions about our genre that we need very kind of binary tropes, and we need to know who's good and who's bad quickly. And I don't really trust that sort of system of ordering humanity, and I have to believe that there are reasons that people behave badly and do bad things and harm others. I have to believe that there are reasons that go beyond pure evil.
There's also something very LA about
yes.
this.
Yeah.
And this is an LA dinner party
it
in
is.
The Hollywood Hills. It really is stylized.
Yes.
The people are all gorgeous.
There's a sense of opulence, I think,
yeah.
to just the hills themselves, these houses that are just precariously resting on cliffs. It feels understandably like you're on shaky ground, and yet everyone sort of just accepts the illusion that you're on firm ground. And so that in itself I thought was so interesting, just knowing what that drive up to those houses can look like and seeing these houses jutting out of mountainsides. You just wonder, are they just one mid-level earthquake away from
yes,
just saying goodbye,
so.
You know? And so to me, I thought there was something very interesting about that. I thought there was something interesting about this upper middle class status and wealth being kind of expressed sort of relentlessly in the film, the sense of good things are made to be enjoyed and let's open the $1,000 bottles of wine and that kind of decadence. is very particular to places like Los Angeles and to the entertainment industry.
It felt a little like watching a Buñuel movie.
Well, that's a very high compliment. Thank you.
Well, the sense of menace in affluence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I think Phil and Matt, the writers, often talk about there's a quality of extreme, extreme black humor to the setup. Just the idea of discomfort and paranoia taken to this almost unbearable level. There is something almost horribly funny about it until it's not funny.
Right. So this is a departure from your previous two films.
Yes.
So just a quick sketch of your mm-hmm. career. Mm-hmm. You made Girl Fight mm-hmm. and then you made these two big budget movies mm-hmm. and they had big stars in them like yes. Charlize Theron and Megan Fox. Mm-hmm. And you worked within the Hollywood system. And that wasn't successful for you.
You know, I mean, I would say yes. Generally, no, it was not successful for me. But I learned a lot. I was able to really flex quite a few muscles and take advantage of a lot of resources to do that flexing. But in the end, I think for me, I just came to a place where I realized I have a lot I want to say. And I'm not really looking to dilute the most meaningful things that I'm trying to say by the means of production itself. I don't want that to be the thing that dilutes the meaning.
So is it a question of you saying, no, you're turning down big Hollywood movies?
I'm not at this moment turning down any big Hollywood movies. I think what it is I'm turning down the idea, the fantasy, that movies can get better through committee. I just don't actually believe it, and I don't think that audiences necessarily tell you the movie that they want to see. I think you give them the movie they want. And I think audiences want to be surprised. They want to have moments of not knowing. I think they need moments of being uncomfortable and challenged. And I don't know if you can turn it around and ask the audience to tell you what to do as the artist. I just don't know if that's a reasonable contract.
That's certainly what Steve Jobs once said or something along those lines.
Oh, really?
You give people what they don't know they want yet.
Oh, yeah, sure. I guess I kind of believe that.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Karin Kusama. She has a new movie out. It's called The Invitation. And your movie, Aeon Flux, mm-hmm. came out in 2005.
Uh-huh.
That starred Charlize Theron. Mm-hmm. You contemplated taking your name off that movie?
I did. The movie had really drifted pretty far from what my original intentions were with it and what my original hopes for the finished movie would be. But in the end, I decided that I still wanted to honor all the work I had done on it and all the work all these other people had done on it. I just didn't want to walk away from it.
And you objected to the fact that they kind of took it over from you and re-edited it and
yeah.
turned it into something you didn't want it to be.
Yes, absolutely. It's an age-old Hollywood story,
right.
And I got to experience one of the classics.
Well, a lot of attention has been paid to this issue of women in Hollywood mm-hmm. and women directors and what they have to face to get their movies made.
Mm-hmm.
How was your experience in those lines? I mean, did you experience overt sexism when it came to making these movies within the studio system?
You know, it's very interesting because on the one hand, I think overt sexism would make things a lot easier. It would make things a lot clearer for everyone if we had more evidence to draw from. I think what's more troubling and more difficult to identify and really kind of unravel is the unconscious assumptions and the unconscious hoops that more female filmmakers are asked to jump through than their male counterparts. You know, I think this is an issue in culture in general, you know, who gets the last word of history, who gets the last word of the narrative. And more women need to own that narrative. It's just part of the balance of working towards some kind of progress in my mind.
And so when you say the last word, are you talking about Aeon Flux with the editing that they took it from you?
Well, I mean, in film, definitely the final cut is the holy grail.
Right.
So that is sort of your last word. But also just the ability to make the decision and be sort of respected as the person who makes the decision. You know, I think there's a bit of a fantasy around the decisive, I want to say almost aggressively decisive male director who knows what he wants and no one gets in his way, nothing stops him. I think when women behave in that way, they really are looked at like, you know, crazy unicorns, and it's not pretty. I don't think people want that. And I don't know for myself that I want to present that way because that's not who I am. I'm actually an incredibly collaborative person, and I want and need to hear the opinions of my creative team. But I don't know if women as frequently get to just simply say, you know, I've thought about everything that everyone said, and here's what we're doing. This is the decision.
But do you think that you cannot make it the film that you want to make inside the Hollywood system? Do you feel like having this final say, this control that you sit, mm-hmm. that you talk about, that is so important to you, that it can only be done
outside of the system?
The system, making an independent?
I do think in the studio system, it's completely possible to find partners who collaborate with you, who respect you, and who ultimately give you the space to make the best version of your movie. I haven't found it yet, and I know it's out there. I'm just looking for the right match, you know?
So how did you get this film financed?
We financed through an incredible financing organization called Game Changer Films. They are a consortium of investors who have committed themselves to investing in films directed by women. So all of the films they make are only directed by women.
Wow.
Yes. You know, when people ask me, do I think things are different for women, I just have to point to how my film got made and just say, yes, unfortunately, they are different. They're so different that this sort of radical group of progressive investors are the only way I ended up getting my film made.
So you got great critical response for this movie.
Yeah.
Invitation.
I'm very pleased. I'm surprised and very pleased.
Why are you surprised?
You know, the movie is, to me, a reflection of something very personal for me, which is a sense that pain puts us in really weird positions over the course of our life, but that ultimately I don't know if we'd ever want to trade it for a false serenity. I mean, it's a really, I think, challenging film in that regard. I think it rewards patience, and it's a crazy ride for movie lovers, but it's not for everyone. And so to have it be critically liked at all is wonderful, you know, and sort of surprising to me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you. This was really fun. I listen to your show all the time.
Oh, well, thank you. Karin Kusama, she directed the new film, The Invitation, in theaters now. And coming up on this program, how Theranos became the hot Silicon Valley company and why it's now being investigated by the feds, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The bad news continues to roll in for Theranos, the Silicon Valley-based blood testing company that was valued at $9 billion. Just a few years ago, its Wunderkind CEO, Elizabeth Holmes, was the subject of glowing media profiles. She gave a TED Talk, of course. Today, the company she founded is the subject of a criminal probe by the Justice Department and is also being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission over allegations of fraud. Regulators are considering banning Holmes from owning or running blood testing labs for 2 years. Joining me now to talk about this and what it says about the bigger picture of Silicon Valley deal making is Nick Stockton, Wired staff writer. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, first, tell us what was so revolutionary about Theranos' blood testing methods.
Well, Theranos was exciting for three reasons. Number one is they promised to make your blood draws be pain-free, or at least mitigate the pain a lot. It was, instead of sticking a big needle in your arm and pulling out a bunch of blood, they would pull out just a drop by doing a finger prick. And then the second thing is they were going to undercut the cost. They were going to be like half as cheap. They were going to be half the Medicare reimbursement rate of standard tests. Also, they're going to make those costs transparent, which is also pretty important.
Right. And the CEO, she's appealing. She's young. She's photogenic. Like I said, she gave a TED Talk. She wears black turtlenecks. And she wrote an op-ed recently about these new Theranos wellness centers in Arizona, saying that this is basically a new era of preventive care, a model for a new era of preventive care in our country. She said that this is a new era, she said this new era thing three times in this op-ed, of individual empowerment to take control of our own health. I mean, she really promised a revolution.
Right, right. And this was something, you know, even in my reporting, I've spoken to a lot of physicians and professionals in diagnostic testing, and this is, people were excited about this. The, you know, it's really cumbersome to get a test, and it's very expensive for people, and they were promising, like, really quick turnarounds and you know, the price transparency and everything. And then also a lot of tests, like, not having to have a doctor's note to go in and get a test. They were very heavily lobbied for that successfully in Arizona. You can just walk into a Walgreens and get a Theranos test if you want.
And the company was valued at $9 billion, so apparently a lot of investors liked it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It was very exciting for a lot of investors here in the Valley.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's happening now with these investigations? What are the feds looking at?
So this all goes back to the last October, Wall Street Journal published a big bombshell of an investigative piece about Theranos. I'm sure, you know, most people listening maybe are familiar with this, but mm-hmm. they alleged that Theranos' technology, which was, you know, to be able to do these tests, run up to 70 tests on a single drop of blood, which is pretty impressive, actually don't work. They were allegedly using the standard kind of the industry standard tests to run their tests and then say that the results, the successful results coming off of those industry standard testing devices were the results coming off of their proprietary devices.
So, yeah, so they have this device called the Edison, they were saying, was revolutionary in the sense of how it would process these tests and could do a million tests from just 200 or so tests from a single prick. And that wasn't happening?
Right. It was actually, they could do up to 200 tests on their testing menu. 70 tests per drop of blood was their highest claim. Yeah, right. So the machine, so if you're pulling a drop of blood, if you have that small amount of blood, it kind of acts differently. It's a liquid, but it's not like a liquid in like a water in your cup. It's going to act more like lava or something, a little more viscous. You're actually dealing with like platelets moving against each other and stuff, and trying to find the enzymes and little proteins and whatever else you're looking for in the blood is pretty difficult at that point, especially at the dilution rates that you're dealing with that much blood. So it's a really difficult problem to solve. And what they were doing allegedly is taking these finger pricks and then diluting them with, you know, enzymes or whatever and running them through bigger machines, which is a big no-no. Yeah.
So the feds are investigating whether or not they're investigating fraud or misleading investors?
Right, yeah. So the investors, you know, they put a bunch of money in this company and they promised that they would have these machines that would work and do all these things they promised. And like Elizabeth Holmes said, revolutionized healthcare. You can imagine if, you know, these were opened up to people, people would have to go to a doctor's note to get this stuff. That's huge. The diagnostic industry is $73 billion in the U.S. every year. So that's their, you know, the big thing to take a bite out of. So $9 billion seems, you know, if they could do it, that seems like a pretty reasonable thing to value it at.
So is this being seen as a cautionary Silicon Valley tale?
Possibly. The chair of the SEC, Mary Jo White, last month, she actually gave a speech or gave a talk, and she mentioned that she was going to be looking more closely at these so-called unicorns, companies like Theranos that are valued at over $1 billion, or specifically startups valued over $1 billion.
Nick Stockton, staff writer for Wired, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Madeline. Have a nice day.
You too. And Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hi there.
Hello. The unicorn of the studio right now.
That would be you.
That would be me.
Valued at well over $1 billion.
And the SEC is not looking into me right now.
Yet.
Yeah. So we opened the show with a big ol' happy 420 to our listeners. And I ran a poll on Twitter during the show asking which of the debauched holidays was the best debauched holiday. And so I gave four choices. 420, obviously. St. Patrick's Day, Halloween, and Earth Day, because I think we should turn that into
is that
a drinking
debauched
holiday. It can be. That is why I put that there. But people are heavy on 420 today. Maybe they're biased because I was asking on the day in which the holiday is happening, but not a lot of love for St. Patrick's Day. Even Earth Day is getting a little bit more love. But our very own Eric J. Lawrence here at the station is like, no love for Cinco de Mayo? Which makes me think I shall probably should have made it an open question because New Year's Eve should have been on there as well. But we do want to hear from you.
Pretty much any holiday can be a debauched holiday.
Yeah, Christmas, man. Bring it on. Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is a different kind of debauchery,
Passover.
Though. Like eating your way from like a bowl of stuffing out. That is my kind of debauchery on Thanksgiving. And therefore, that is the superlative debauched holiday.
Okay. Thank you very much, Julie Myers, expert in debauchery. And if you want to weigh in on anything, our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play, and our phone number is 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.